Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Christopher James Clark as my special expert guest. Christopher Clark is an award-winning nutritional science writer and an accomplished chef. He is the author of Nutritional Grail and a regular columnist for Dr. Lauren Cordain's ThePaleoDiet.com. Christopher serves on the advisory board of the Middle East edition of Men's Health magazine and writes for various top-tier news outlets, including Men's Health, Women's Health, and the Huffington Post. Originally from the U.S., Christopher is currently based in Dubai, where he works in the F&B industry as a consultant and entrepreneur. For inspiration tips and over 400 recipes, please visit his blog at ChristopherJamesClark.com. Good evening, Chris, and welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. And for us, it's morning. It's about 10:30 here in Vernon, British Columbia, which is a small little town in British Columbia. Have you been to this neck of the woods?
I haven't been there, no. I grew up in Michigan, quite close to the Canadian border, but the other side of Canada, so I haven't been over in BC.
Right, and you're in Dubai now, but let's talk about life growing up in the U.S. because, you know, as Canadians, it's kind of similar, but there are differences. So what was your lifestyle like? Talk about your diet, if you played any sports, that kind of thing, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I grew up eating what's commonly known as the SAD diet, standard American diet, which is full of sugar and processed foods, especially at that time in the 80s. So my diet was not so good. At the same time, kind of one of the guiding themes of my life was at that time was watching my grandmother battle heart disease. She had her first heart attack when I was 3 years old, and she died when I was 18. So for all of those years, I was watching her battle this disease, and it was quite clear in my mind that there was some connection between lifestyle and exercise and nutrition and diet. So I grew up trying to like eat what I thought was a healthy diet, but you know, at that time it was really hard to get good information, and you know, that was the kind of low fat era where we were kind of seduced into this idea that fat is bad and we should be avoiding it at all costs. So I was eating this kind of diet thinking that I was doing good for my health, but as I later found out, it was probably the opposite. So yeah, played sports and ran cross country in high school for 2 years, and then later switched over to football, ran track. So it was quite active.
Sounds good. So you're living in Dubai now, which, you know, from our point of view here, it seems like a long way away. But how did you end up living there?
I came here 3 years ago. I was invited to come here as a consultant on a restaurant project. So that's one of the things I do in my work is to create recipes, health conscious recipes. So it was a new restaurant and I was the food consultant, the recipe consultant. So I came here for what I thought was going to be a 6-week project. And then when I was here, I just kind of saw that there's a lot of potential here, especially for what I'm doing with respect to healthy food. And I just saw some opportunities and decided to stay and see how things go. So it's going quite well so far, 3 years into it.
Yeah. Now, I traveled quite a bit in the Middle East in the 80s, and I'm certain that things have changed, but I didn't get to Dubai. So what is life like there? I've heard different things about what we take for granted here, but what's life there in terms of freedom, politics, safety, your safety in particular? Is it a safe place to live, and is it a good place to live?
For safety, I have to say it's probably the safest place in the world. Like the worst crime you might hear about is like a bicycle getting stolen, you know? So it's a place where there's no, virtually no violent crime, because everybody who's here has a job. And if you don't have a job, then you don't stay. So I think poverty is what's driving a lot of crime when people don't have opportunities and they resort to different tactics. So that's kind of off the table here. Politics, you know, it's different. But for me, it's kind of like, I think of it in the same way as like if you're joining a company, you don't talk bad about the company. Even if you think something bad about it, you just kind of mind your own business because you're there to do a job and you're there because it's a mutually beneficial situation. So I don't think about living in Dubai forever. And I think most of the people who are here who are foreigners, which is like 80% of the population, it's also kind of like a temporary thing because it's a place where there's a lot of opportunities and you can come here and advance your career and have some great experiences. So overall, it's a great place to live, I have to say.
I just spoke with one of my students in Saudi Arabia, and he says there's an epidemic there with obesity because people don't move, they don't walk, they drive cars, there's a lot of prestige. Is that true also there? Do you see a lot of obesity? Do you see a lot of illness in the population, or is it not like that?
Yeah, it's definitely very prevalent throughout the Middle East. For obesity, it's quite on par with the way that it is in the U.S. I think it's about two-thirds of the population is either overweight or obese based on the body mass index calculation. And on top of that, there's a very high prevalence of childhood obesity. I think I read recently that 40% of teenagers and under are obese. So that's a huge problem. On top of that, diabetes is a huge problem. I've also read recently that 19% of the population here has type 2 diabetes. And all of these problems are more or less indirectly or directly related to high consumption of sugar. So you definitely see that. I mean, the healthy food offering is quite behind here. That's one reason why I decided to stay here, is because the market for introducing a healthy food concepts is far from saturated. As if you go into some bigger centers in the U.S., like L.A., New York, those cities, you know, it's the mainstream. But here, it's still new. So the health problems are kind of like opening up an opportunity or a window for people like me to come and say, well, okay, here's a solution, you know.
What would the job market there be like, say, for personal trainers or health consultants like yourself? Is there a lot of opportunity? Is it difficult to make an application for a visa to live there? What was your experience like?
My experience, no, it's not difficult. You just have to go through the proper channels in terms of getting yourself a working visa. So I ended up staying here for about a year and a half, just like as a tourist, who I would just have a 30-day visa and then just cross the border and get it renewed, which it's totally legal to do that, but it was just a bit inconvenient. And then finally, I joined up with a friend who's now my business partner, so I got my visa under his company. But in terms of the market for personal trainers and health coaches and stuff, I think there's a big demand for it because there's a lot of health problems, as we just discussed. And on top of that, it's a place where, you know, there's a lot of disposable income. Standard of living is quite high. I think the GDP is about 2.5 times the global average. So people have money here. And as health is such a cherished thing, if you're in a bad state of health and somebody is there to kind of help you with the solutions, I think the job market is good for that. And I think it will continue to grow.
Great. Well, let's get into your book. You know, I learned of you through your articles and blogs, mainly through Lauren Cordain and the paleodiet.com newsletter. Excellent information, well-researched. And now that I'm reading your book, or actually listening to it in audio format, The Nutritional Grail, really enjoying the information. And I'd like you maybe to get into that a little bit. So, Nutritional Grail, Ancestral Wisdom, Breakthrough Science, and the Dawning Nutritional Renaissance. So, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, you just mentioned well-researched, so I'm really happy to hear that, because what inspired me to write it was kind of like a series of disappointments. You know, reading different nutrition books, and there was no documentation, or the documentation was really sparse, so you were just kind of expected to trust that the author, who maybe was a doctor or scientist or maybe not, but in any case, the reader is expected to just accept that this person is an authority and therefore is right. So I was like a little bit more inquisitive, and I just wanted to see like where that information that those people were talking about was coming from. So I didn't really start with the intention of writing a book, but I just kind of started doing my own research project and looking into the key areas of nutrition, fat, protein, carbohydrates, and all kinds of different concepts which are either accepted or somewhat controversial, like should we eat meat or not, acid and alkaline type of things, all different concepts that you can easily see on Facebook, somebody who's posting pictures and saying like, this is the truth, but okay, is there some science behind it? So I started researching it and just taking my notes and documenting everything that I was looking into, and then decided to make it into a book. And for me, it was really important that the book is heavily documented. So there's 500 citations in the book. So pretty much every point that I'm making, the reader has the ability to go and look at the source of that information and then to decide for himself if it's a valid point that I'm making. So that was the inspiration.
Now, just to play the devil's advocate, wouldn't it be true that, say, 99% of readers would never actually go to any of those references? Like, that's my experience, because I'm into research and medicine, and I find that the general lay public have absolutely no desire or know-how. And also, you mentioned this in your book. Isn't it possible to pull references and put them in a book that are skewed, outdated, fudged, corrupted? Isn't that also possible?
Yeah, of course it's possible. And of course it's true that most people will never go and look at the references. So I decided to make the writing style of the book very accessible and write it in terms that is very easy for anybody to understand. So even if you're not interested in going and looking at the references, at least the book is clear and coherent and straightforward. In terms of references, yeah, that's a huge problem in nutrition science in general, is that, you know, you can have one study which is telling you that meat is good, and then you can have another study or book that is telling you that meat is bad, or whatever the topic is. So, no, I think there's a way of pulling apart those studies. It turns out that a lot of the confusion comes from accepting epidemiological studies as truth, when in fact those are just observational studies, which doesn't necessarily prove that there's a scientific causation between a cause and effect. So it's just looking at a population and saying, okay, this population eats a lot of meat and they have a high rate of cancer. So is it because they eat a high rate of meat that they have the cancer? Not necessarily. And so I made the point in the book that a lot of the confusion is based on accepting epidemiological studies as the standard, when in fact those studies, when you find a correlation, that's a good starting point for then taking that correlation and then developing a randomized controlled trial, which would be a more proper scientific study, which could give you a better feeling that it's a causative factor. So.
Now, just to be clear, so that our listeners can be clear, and because of your connection to Lauren and the so-called paleo diet, and keeping in mind that what I like in your book is that you don't use a label, a guru reference. You're talking about a scientific, logical, rational approach to eating. But just to be clear, you're not advocating a vegan approach to eating as an ideal way to eat. And if that's true, which I assume it is, why not? Because a lot of people in the health field, including people that I know, say, well, Corey, you know, you're a vegan, aren't you? You're a vegetarian. You're into the health field, so that means you're a vegan. And of course, I tell them, no, I'm an omnivore, and I eat vegetarian, so you better be careful and be happy that I just ate if you're a vegetarian. So what is your take on this movement of veganism and vegetarianism today, which is widespread?
Yeah, it's widespread. I mean, my take on it is twofold. One is from personal experience, and one is from looking at all the scientific studies on vegetarian and veganism. So before I came to Dubai, I was living in Europe for 8 years, different places. One of the places I lived it was in Greece, and at that time I was running the kitchen of a yoga retreat. So yoga and vegan vegetarian diet are quite closely related. Like, the people who are into yoga are quite often into those diets. So I, by association, kind of gravitated towards those diets, and for a couple of years I was doing vegan diet. So at the beginning I felt good on it, but after some time my health deteriorated, and this was another thing that kind of prompted me to do the research for the book, is to see, like, is there some scientific underpinning for saying that the ideal human diet should be vegan or vegetarian or not. So from my personal experience, it doesn't work for me. I'm not saying that it can't work for some people, because some people, they seem to be doing okay on it, even long term, but I would still be suspicious. And in terms of scientific backing, I mean, it's one thing to say that the vegan diet works for this specific person. That's fine. If it's working for them and they're in good health, that's great. But to say that the non-vegan foods, animal foods, are unhealthy, inherently unhealthy, as, you know, like Colin Campbell or somebody like that is saying, when I look at the scientific studies on that he's referencing and other vegans are referencing, for me it's far from the truth, and quite the contrary, that animal foods are very healthy and health supportive, and that we should be including them in the diet. And of course, it depends on the quality of the animal food, just as it does the quality of the vegetable food. If it's a chicken that you raise in your backyard and you're feeding it the proper diet and then you're taking those eggs, it's a different story from eating eggs from a huge factory farm setting. So my take on vegetarian veganism is that I think most people do better with the introduction of some animal foods. And I think the science is supportive of that argument. But if nutrition is kind of a thing where what works for you, if it contradicts a study, then you have to trust your own body. So I support anybody who's eating vegetarian and vegan and it's working for them. But if it's not working, I encourage them to step outside the box and maybe question if it's a dogma or some kind of other reason that they're doing it, or if they're just doing it because they heard their friends were doing it or it's popular. So to try to look into it a bit more open-mindedly and looking at the science behind those diets.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, well, that's a safe place and a good position to have because you're not driving everyone away from a very distinct, solid, one-sided approach. I think the distinction you made about quality of animal as well as plants. We've got vegans that eat white bread and white sugar, and vegans that don't, that eat very clean. And then, of course, we have the opposite. That's true. So that's great. So in your book, I think the analogy you made to Percival and the search for the Holy Grail was great. It really helps people understand through analogy and comparison the points that you're trying to make. So just in a nutshell, could you kind of summarize these comparisons that you're trying to make from the search for the Holy Grail to nutrition today, and then maybe some of the stuff that's happened between the time that book was written, I think the 12th century, and the idea came up, and then where we are today and what we've gone through?
Yeah, sure. Well, the interesting thing about the period when that book was, or it was originally like a poem, which was written by a French poet, it came around in the end of the 12th century. So that's after the Dark Ages, but before the Renaissance. So this is a period of like great transition in society and in the mind of the individual. And so that's a very important time. The reason I call the book The Dawning Nutritional Renaissance is because, in my view, we've just been through the Dark Ages of nutrition, which is the 20th century, and we're going towards a renaissance, a nutritional renaissance, which means that we're coming to a more scientific and more solid understanding of what proper nutrition is. It's dawning. It's coming. We're not there yet, but we're after the Dark Ages, but before the Renaissance. So as the Grail came, and the story of the Grail came in history between those original periods, that's why I call the book The Nutritional Grail. But the story of Percival is essentially a story of a boy who's the son of a great warrior who's fighting in the Crusades, and his father dies in the Crusades. His mother decides that she doesn't want him to grow up and have the same fate as his father, so she raises him in seclusion in the woods and raises him to be quite naive and to not ask too many questions. When he's growing up, when he's a teenager, he sees some knights in the woods, and he didn't even know that the knighthood existed. But they convince him and show him that he should be a knight, and he has his heart set on it, and he goes to train to be a knight. And while he's training, his mentor and his superiors tell him that he should never ask questions. He asks a lot of questions, and they tell him, look, the knight doesn't ask questions, he just takes orders. And so after he finishes his training, he's on a mission where he's in the woods, and finally he's looking for a place to stay at night. The sun is setting, and kind of miraculously, a huge castle appears out of nowhere. And he goes into this castle, and he's welcomed there. He's given a room, and later that night he's invited to a ceremony. And he later finds out that this is a ceremony of the Holy Grail. And the Grail is the healing grail, where every person who drinks from it is healed from whatever ails them. And the kingdom where this castle is in a huge chaos because everything's fallen apart. And basically, Percival is a knight who's in this situation, and there's a prophecy in that castle that says that there's going to be a knight who comes along, or a boy who comes along and who witnesses the ceremony, who will ask an important question, which is, who does the Grail serve? And by asking that question, the kingdom will be restored. So, and the long and the short of it is that Percival, he doesn't ask the question when he's in this situation because of the way he's raised from his mother and because of the training that he had as a knight. He wakes up the next day and the castle has disappeared, and he realizes that he's missed his chance to attain the Grail. And that kind of sets the course of his life. He goes on and goes through many missions and different achievements, but he's always in the back of his mind trying to get back to that place where he can ask the question and have the Grail. And the story of the Grail is essentially one of introspection and looking within, asking questions, seeking knowledge, and also helping other people. So I thought it was quite appropriate for this kind of process of asking questions and seeking knowledge is quite appropriate for just anyone who's interested in nutrition, because there's so much information out there and so many conflicting views. And finally, I think if you really want to go into it, you know, it's not enough to just read a book, whether it's mine or anyone else's. You know, you have to look at the pros and cons, the arguments on all different sides. And also you have to just experience it within your own body. And that also involves learning how to cook and learning how food works in your own experience. So I think it's an appropriate story. And I encourage people to read the longer version to get the full gist of it.
Yes, so would I. Yeah, it's a great story and a great analogy, especially when it comes to ideas like keeping your mouth and mind shut and just obeying orders, which is how I think essentially we're trained in the public education system today. Now, you don't like dogma. Tell us why not. Tell us what dogma is to you and why you don't like it.
Well, I would say dogma is a belief which is put forth as truth. And as it's coined like that, you're not expected to ever question it. It's an absolute truth, and it doesn't matter if there's any facts or any science or any kind of logic or reason to support it. So I think religion is quite a topic which maybe is a bit sensitive, but I think for sure if we look at religion critically, we can see that there's a lot of dogma that goes into it. And so for me, I was realizing that in science, you can also get dogma, which is ironic because the spirit of science is actually an anti-dogmatic spirit. I was looking for the quote before the interview. I couldn't remember who said it, but there was a great quote. Basically, the guy said that the spirit of science is essentially coming up with a theory and then making relentless attempts to prove that theory wrong. So basically, what he's saying is that it's good to be wrong in science because that means you're getting closer to the truth of whatever you're trying to investigate. So there's no shame in being wrong in science. And it's a good thing because it means you're getting closer to the truth. But I think that the ego kind of gets involved. And especially when you're talking about like big institutions, like let's say, for example, the American Heart Association, there's a huge amount of money and a huge power that's behind it. And when they come forth with a position that says, for example, dietary cholesterol is bad for your heart and bad for your cholesterol levels, if that idea is later proven wrong, which now it's quite clear that even Dietary Guidelines Committee, which creates the dietary guidelines for Americans, they've indicated that they're going to be dropping the 300 milligrams per day of dietary cholesterol requirement that they've had for decades, and based on the conclusion that there's no scientific evidence to support it. So the point is that when an institution comes forward with a strong position and says you should not eat cholesterol or you should not eat saturated fat, they would rather not admit that they're wrong and just continue to be wrong just to keep face, you know? So it's this idea that they're pushing a dogma and they're like embarrassed. I think they feel that they're discredited or it ruins their reputation if they come out and say, oh guys, sorry, we were wrong about that. But for anyone who really cares about science, I think it's quite admirable and quite honorable for you to say, okay, well, yeah, we were wrong, but so what? Now we found out based on this study and this study and this study that we were wrong, but now we're going towards the truth. So that's why I don't like dogmas, because it kind of contaminates and pollutes science when actually the true spirit of science is an anti-dogmatic spirit.
Yes, excellent. Well said. I don't accept certainty as science promulgates. I think in terms of probability and data, rationality, reason, logic, and I think that you're coming across in that sense too, which is fantastic. You know, the scientific methodology, if applied to everything in life, almost like Spock and Star Trek, would keep us out of a lot of trouble, especially when it comes to personal health and wellness. It would prevent us from getting sucked in to these ridiculous vortexes that people find themselves in. Now, we're running out of time. It's a great interview, great concept that you're coming across with. I just want to ask you one more question, and sure. That is, what's your take on sugar? The world that I live in since I was 17, 40 years ago, I learned it was white death, poisonous, toxic, evil, destructive, the source of the slave trade, and on it goes. So to me, it hasn't changed, but we've got massive numbers of people eating their own body weight in sugar every year, and it's increasing. So with all the evidence, all the science, all the evidence of what they call self-evidence, it's just right in front of you. You can see what happens to people everywhere. They're getting fat and sick and diabetic and depressed. Why do we have this sugar addiction that continues to, you know, facilitate all of this damage around us? Why isn't there any change? Why isn't there any descent away from the madness?
Well, you're absolutely right. I think the reason is, A, because sugar is addictive, and the more that you eat of it, the more you tend to want. Another reason is because for the last decade, when we were told that fat was the enemy, by consequence, when the food manufacturers decreased the fat in all the products, the sugar went up in order to make it palatable. And also, like, you know, there's only three macronutrients: fat, protein, and carbohydrates. So if you decrease the fat, necessarily either by a proportion, either the protein or the carbs are going to go up. But I think that I'm actually quite encouraged by future prospects of decreased sugar consumption, because A, the science is becoming just so much more clear on this, that there are certain areas of nutrition science that are definitely debatable and definitely not settled. But the fact that excessive sugar consumption is bad for you, and that means, well, I mean, the World Health Organization came out earlier this year and said that we should eat no more than 10% of our calories as sugar, and they said 5% would be better. And other big governments, UK and US, are also kind of settling in on this 10% number. I mean, I think 5% is better. But on top of that, there was this really interesting report which just came out last month from Credit Suisse. So Credit Suisse is the second biggest bank in Switzerland, and their research arm released this report, which is called something like Fat, the New Paradigm. And it was a report like written for investors. And they're telling investors that fat consumption from now until 2030 is going to be going up huge. 43%, I think it was, increase in fat. That's also including the population increase. But they said, I can't remember the exact number, but let's say fat is accounting for like 20% of calories now. It's going to go up to like 25. So carbs and sugar are going to go down and fat is going to go up. That's what they're telling investors. So the food industry is going to be trending towards increased fat and lower sugar. And where there's money to be made, I think the companies are going to jump on that. And people are just going to find that the supermarkets where they used to shop that had high sugar products, is they're going to be seeing a reduction in sugar and subsequently an increase of fat. So I think it's a problem that happened over the course of definitely the last century was the time when it really skyrocketed. I looked at the sugar consumption over the course of, well, 200 years in my book, and basically in the early 1800s, people were eating around 7 pounds of sugar per person per year. That's when sugar started to become affordable. Before that, in the 1700s, you mentioned the slave trade and all of that. Before the slave trade and everything, sugar was really, they called it white gold because it was highly coveted, like in England, but people couldn't afford it. So basically, but during the 1800s, it was around 7 pounds per person per year, 1900, 43 pounds, and then today it's something around 100 pounds. So this problem developed over the course of several hundred years, but in an intensive phase for like about 50 years during the last century. So it's not going to change overnight. But I think if we have the same conversation 20 years from now, I think we're going to be looking at a world where people eat a lot less sugar. I think we're going in the right direction, but it's going to take time.
Well, that's great. That sounds very encouraging. And I appreciate that input. Now, what's your website address, Chris? And what will we find there when we get there?
So the website address is my full name, ChristopherJamesClark.com. You can also just search Nutritional Grail in Google and you'll come to my site. And on the site, so I'm quite interested in making nutrition practical and easy and showing people how easy it is to cook really simple, delicious, healthy meals. So you'll find a lot of recipes there. I think now it's upwards of 400 recipes. And you'll find links to my articles that I write for paleodiet.com, Huffington Post, and others, and just some solid background information of my work and what I do. So,
well, that's excellent. Okay, so that's it for this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. Chris, our time is gone, and it was great having you on the show. We'll make this available to all of our students and graduates worldwide, actually. We have close to 6,000 now. And they'll learn about your book, and I would encourage everyone listening to get a copy. I'm really enjoying the book, and it's a great gift also for this Christmas to get someone on the right track. You're a chef. You're committed to whole food. I can tell that you're committed to science and research, which is excellent. I commend you for that. How about a final parting word, Chris, to encourage us to search for our own holy grail and find truth in the manner that you advocate?
Well, I would just reiterate that it all starts in the kitchen. So I know everybody has a busy lifestyle, and sometimes people don't have, maybe they think they don't have time to cook, but I would like to show people that you do have time to cook. And if you're reliant on restaurants and other outside people to prepare the food that actually goes in your body, I think you're at a significant setback. So try to learn about food and nutrition from a really hands-on perspective. And that means getting in the kitchen and making some tasty, healthy food.
Christopher James Clark is an award-winning nutritional science writer and an accomplished chef. He lives in Dubai, and he's the author of Nutritional Grail, and a regular columnist for Dr. Lauren Cordain's ThePaleoDiet.com. Chris, we thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Holly Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHolly.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Represent his lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU. Sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight. Malik with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life. Live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHolly.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.